RelicRadio.com presents tales of the strange and bizarre, the weird and the wicked. Stories not necessarily of the supernatural, but of the unnatural. Join us now for Strange Tales, featuring radio drama at its most mysterious and unusual. This week on Strange Tales, we'll hear two stories from the world's greatest short stories. The first is from October 10th, 1940. It's titled The Case of Monsieur Valdemar. After that, it's The Man and the Snake, their episode from October 14th, 1940.
National Broadcasting Company brings you the unique narrative dramas of Nelson Olmsted, who invites you to enjoy with him the brilliant entertainment in the world's greatest short stories. The world of literature has given us many narratives with the power to take us into them, to let us live for a few minutes the unusual lives that make a story. Again tonight, Nelson Olmsted brings to life another literary masterpiece, which because of its dramatic power makes an interesting radio presentation. Here is another of the world's greatest short stories, and Nelson Olmsted.
The power to hypnotize has always fascinated men, especially authors with active minds. For instance, Edgar Allan Poe in our story tonight shows a very mysterious effect of mesmerism in the case of Monsieur Valdemar. My attention for the last 3 years had been repeatedly drawn to the subject of mesmerism. And about 9 months ago, it occurred to me quite suddenly that in the series of experiments made hitherto, there had been a very remarkable and most unaccountable omission. No person had as yet been mesmerized in the act of dying. It remained to be seen first whether in such conditions there existed in the patient any susceptibility to the magnetic influence. And secondly, whether, if any existed, it was impaired or increased by the condition. Thirdly, to what extent or for how long a period the encroachments of death might be arrested by the process. There were other points to be ascertained, but these most excited my curiosity, the last in especial, from the immensely important character of its consequences. In looking around me for some subject by whose means I might test these particulars, I was brought to think of my friend Monsieur Ernest Valdemar, the well-known author. For some months previous to my becoming acquainted with him, his physicians had declared him to be a confirmed phthisis. It was his custom, indeed, to speak calmly of his approaching dissolution as a matter neither to be avoided nor regretted. When the ideas to which I have alluded first occurred to me, it was, of course, very natural that I should think of Monsieur Valdemar. I knew the steady philosophy of the man too well to apprehend any scruples from him, and he had no relatives in America who would be likely to interfere. I spoke to him frankly upon the subject, and to my surprise, his interest seemed vividly excited. I say to my surprise, for although he had always yielded his person freely to my experiments, he had never before given me any tokens of sympathy with what I did. His disease was of that character which would admit of exact calculation in respect to the epoch of its termination and death. And it was finally arranged between us that he would send for me about 24 hours before the period announced by his physician as that of his decease. It is now rather more than 7 months since I received from Monsieur Valdemar himself the subjoined note. You may as well come now. My doctors have agreed that I cannot hold out beyond tomorrow midnight. And I think they've hit the time very nearly. Signed, Valdemar. I received this note within half an hour after it was written. And in 15 minutes more, I was in the dying man's chamber. I had not seen him for 10 days. And was appalled by the fearful alteration which the brief interval had wrought in him. His face wore a leaden hue. The eyes were utterly lusterless. And the emaciation was so extreme that the skin had been broken through by the cheekbones. After pressing Valdemar's hand, I took his doctors aside and obtained from them a minute account of the patient's condition. Before they left, they promised to return about 10 o'clock the next night. According to their opinion, Valdemar would die around midnight the next night. When they'd gone, I spoke freely with Monsieur Valdemar on the subject of his approaching dissolution, as well as, more particularly, of the experiment proposed. He still professed himself quite willing and even anxious to have it made, and urged me to commence it at once. It had been my design originally to wait for the physicians, but I was induced to proceed, first, by the urgent entreaties of Monsieur Valdemar, and secondly, by my conviction that I had not a moment to lose as he was evidently sinking fast. I commenced the passes, which I had already found most effectual in subduing him. He was evidently influenced by the first lateral stroke of my hand across his forehead. But although I exerted all my powers, no further perceptible effect was induced until some minutes after 10 o'clock, when the doctors called. I proceeded without hesitation, exchanging, however, the lateral passes for downward ones, and directing my gaze entirely into the right eye of the sufferer. By this time, his pulse was imperceptible, and his breathing stertorous, and at intervals of half a minute. This condition was nearly unaltered for a quarter of an hour. And at the expiration of this period, however, a natural, although a very deep sigh, escaped from the bosom of the dying man, and the breathing ceased. That is to say, its stertorousness was no longer apparent. The intervals were undiminished. The patient's extremities were of an icy coldness. At 5 minutes before 11, I perceived unequivocal signs of the mesmeric influence. I could make his eyelids quiver. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, his pulse was imperceptible, the breathing almost stopped. His limbs were rigid and cold as marble. Still, the general appearance was certainly not that of death. I ventured a few words of conversation.
Monsieur Valdemar, I said, are you asleep? He made no answer, but I perceived a tremor about the lips and was thus induced to repeat the question again and again. At its third repetition, his whole frame was agitated by a very slight shivering, and the eyelids unclosed themselves so far as to display a white line of the ball. The lips moved sluggishly, and from between them, in a barely audible whisper, issued the word,
"Yes, asleep now. Do not wake me. Let me die so."
"Do you still feel any pain in the breast, Monsieur Valdemar?"
"No pain. I am dying." At dawn, he was still barely alive. I again asked him if he was asleep. At my fourth repetition of the question, he said, "Yes, still asleep, dying."
Just then, there came a marked change over the countenance of the sleeper. The eyes rolled themselves slowly open, the pupils disappearing upwardly. The skin generally assumed a cadaverous hue, resembling not so much parchment as white paper. The upper lip at the same time writhed itself away from the teeth, which it had previously covered completely, while the lower jaw fell with an audible jerk, leaving the mouth widely extended and disclosing in full view the swollen and blackened tongue. I presume that no member of the party then present had been unaccustomed to deathbed horrors, but so hideous beyond conception was the appearance of Monsieur Valdemar at this moment that there was a general shrinking back from the region of the bed. There was no longer the faintest sign of vitality in Monsieur Valdemar. And concluding him to be dead, we were consigning him to the charge of the nurses, when a strong vibratory motion was observable in the tongue. At the expiration of this period, there issued from the distended and motionless jaws a voice.
such as it would be madness in me to attempt describing. It seemed to reach our ears, at least mine, from a vast distance, or from some deep cavern within the earth. It was a voice of distinct syllabification. Monsieur Valdemar spoke, obviously in reply to a question I had propounded to him a few moments before. I'd asked him, it will be remembered, if he still slept. He now said,
"Yes. No. I have been sleeping. And now I am dead."
No person present even affected to deny or attempted to repress the unutterable, shuddering horror which these few words thus uttered were so well calculated to convey. When we all overcame our stupefaction, we examined the body again for signs of life. There was no breath, and the attempt to draw blood from the arm failed. The only indication, indeed, of the mesmeric influence was now found in the vibratory movement of the tongue whenever I addressed Monsieur Valdemar a question. He seemed to be making an effort to reply, but had no longer sufficient volition. The next day, we discussed the propriety and feasibility of awakening him, but we had little difficulty in agreeing that no good purpose would be served by so doing. It was evident that, so far, death, or what is usually termed death, had been arrested by the mesmeric process. It seemed clear to us all that to awaken Monsieur Valdemar would be merely to ensure his instant, or at least his speedy, dissolution. From this period until the close of last week, an interval of nearly 7 months, we continued to make daily calls at Monsieur Valdemar's house. All this time, the sleeper remained exactly as I have last described him. It was on Friday when we finally resolved to make the experiment of awakening, or attempting to awaken him. I made the customary passes, but these for a time were unsuccessful, and then I asked, "Monsieur Valdemar, can you explain to us what are your feelings or wishes now?" The tongue quivered, or rather rolled violently in the mouth, although the jaws and lips remained rigid as before, and at length, the same hideous voice, which I've already described, broke forth.
"For God's sake, quick, quick, waken me. Quick, I say to you that I am dead."
I was thoroughly unnerved, and for an instant remained undecided what to do. At first, I made an endeavor to recompose the patient, but failing in this through total abeyance of the will, I retracted my steps and as earnestly struggled to awaken him. In this attempt, I soon saw that I should be successful, or at least I soon fancied that my success would be complete, and I am sure that all in the room are prepared to see the patient awaken. For what really happened, however, it is quite impossible that any human being could have been prepared. As I rapidly made the mesmeric passage, his whole frame at once, within the space of a single minute or even less, shrunk, crumbled, absolutely rotted away beneath my hands. Upon the bed, before the whole company, there lay a nearly liquid mass of loathsome, of detestable putrescence.
From the volumes of Edgar Allan Poe, Nelson Armstead has presented The Case of Monsieur Valdemar. Now, here is Nelson Armstead with a closing word.
Of one thing, I think we can be pretty sure, that Poe has a tremendous and loyal following in the United States. His stories on this series always bring the most comments and requests for more of his many stories. In connection with his stories, Poe's life itself makes very interesting reading, because it's so fantastic. But for our next narrative, we've selected from the intensely interesting works of Ambrose Bierce a startling story entitled The Man and the Snake. Be with us next Monday. Until then, good night and good reading.
In NBC presents Nelson Olmsted with his world's greatest short story three nights each week. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at the same time over most of these same stations. Try to be with us for the next short story session when Ambrose Bierce's Tale of a Man with a Fatal Imagination, titled The Man and the Snake, will be reviewed by Nelson Olmsted.
National Broadcasting Company brings you the unique narrative dramas of Nelson Olmsted, who invite you to enjoy with him the brilliant entertainment in the world's greatest short stories. In keeping with the pace of modern life, it is sometimes difficult for us to take the time necessary to read the great literary works of the world, because they, especially short stories, are not easily found. Nelson Olmsted brings you these stories, interpreting the intense drama so well cut by the pen of the capable author. Here is another of the world's greatest short stories, and Nelson Olmsted.
The human mind reacts peculiarly under great stress, especially when overcome with fear. Ambrose Bierce has expressed this condition very vividly in our story tonight, The Man and the Snake. In gown and slippers. Harker Brayton smiled as he read from Moyster's Marvels of Science. It was an ancient book with its archaic English, which stated, "It is a veritable report, and attested of so many that there now be of wise and learned none to gainsay it, that ye serpent, his eyes, hath a magnetic property, that whoso falleth into its suasion is drawn forward in despite of his will, and perisheth miserable by ye creature his bite." Brayton smiled again as he thought, "Now, the only marvel in the matter is that the wise and learned in Moyster's day should have believed such nonsense as is rejected by most of even the ignorant in ours." A train of reflection followed, for Brayton was a man of thought, and he unconsciously lowered his book without altering the direction of his eyes. As soon as the volume had gone below the line of sight, something in an obscure corner of the room recalled his attention to his surroundings. What he saw in the shadow under his bed were two small points of light, apparently about an inch apart. They might have been reflections of the gas jet above him in metal nail heads. He gave them but little thought and resumed his reading. A later something, some impulse, which it did not occur to him to analyze, impelled him to lower the book again and seek for what he saw before. The points of light were still there. They seemed to have become brighter than before, shining with a greenish luster, which he had not at first observed. He thought, too, that they might have moved a trifle, were somewhat nearer. They were still too much in the shadow, however, to reveal their nature and origin to an indolent attention, and he resumed his reading. Suddenly, something in the text suggested a thought which made him start and drop the book for the third time to the side of the sofa, whence, escaping from his hand, it fell sprawling to the floor back upward. Brayton, half risen, was staring intently into the obscurity beneath the bed, where the points of light shone with, it seemed to him, an added fire. His attention was now fully aroused, his gaze eager and imperative. It disclosed, almost directly beneath the foot of the rail of the bed, the coils of a large serpent. The points of light were its eyes. Its horrible head, thrust flatly forth from the innermost coil and resting on the outermost, was directly straight toward him. The definition of the wide, brutal jaw and the idiot-like forehead serving to show the direction of its malevolent gaze. The eyes were no longer merely luminous points. They looked into his own with a meaning, a malign significance.
A snake in a bedroom of a modern city dwelling of the better sort is happily not so common a phenomenon as to make explanation altogether needless. Parker Brayton, a bachelor of 35, a scholar, idler, and something of an athlete, rich and popular and of sound health, had returned to San Francisco from all manner of remote and unfamiliar countries. He had gladly accepted the hospitality of his friend, Dr. Druring, the distinguished scientist whose studies were centered around the lower forms of life. His scientific sympathies, in fact, were distinctly reptilian. He loved nature's vulgarians and described himself as the Zola of zoology. His wife and daughters, not having the advantage to share his enlightened curiosity regarding the works and ways of our ill-starred fellow creatures, were, with needless austerity, excluded from the wing of the house called the snakery. Well, despite the snakery and its uncanny associations, to which, indeed, he gave little attention, Brayton found life at the Druring mansion very much to his mind. Beyond a smart shock of surprise and a shudder of mere loathing, Mr. Brayton was not greatly affected. His first thought was to ring the call bell and bring a servant. But although the bell cord dangled within easy reach, he made no movement toward it. It had occurred to his mind that this act might subject him to the suspicion of fear, which he certainly did not feel. He was more keenly conscious of the incongruous nature of the situation than affected by its perils. It was revolting, but absurd. Brayton rose to his feet and prepared to back softly away from the snake without disturbing it if possible, and through the door. People retire so from the presence of the great, for greatness is power, and power is a menace. He knew that he could walk backward without obstruction and find the door without error. Should the monster follow, the taste which had plastered the walls with paintings had consistently supplied a rack of murderous oriental weapons from which he could snatch one to suit the occasion. In the meantime, the snake's eyes burned with a more pitiless malevolence than ever. Brayton lifted his right foot free of the floor to step backward. That moment, he felt a strong aversion to doing so. He lifted the foot a little higher by slightly bending the knee and thrust it sharply to the floor, an inch in front of the other. He could not think how that occurred. A trial with the left foot had the same result. It was again in advance of the right. The man had an ashy pallor. Again he took a step forward, and another, causing his hand to knock the chair over with a crash. The man groaned. The snake made neither sound nor motion, but its eyes were two dazzling suns. The reptile itself was fully concealed by them. They gave off enlarging rings of rich and vivid colors, which at their greatest expansion successively vanished like soap bubbles. They seemed to approach his very face, and anon were an immeasurable distance away. He heard something somewhere, the continual throbbing of a great drum, with desultory bursts of far music, inconceivably sweet, like the tones of an Aeolian harp. He knew it was the sunrise melody of Memnon's statue, and thought he stood at the Nileside reeds, hearing with exalted sense that immortal anthem through the silence of the centuries. The music ceased. Rather, it became by insensible degrees the distant roll of a retreating thunderstorm. A landscape, glittering with sun and rain, stretched before him, arched with a vivid rainbow, framing in its giant curve 100 visible cities. In the middle distance, a vast serpent wearing a crown reared its head out of its voluminous convolutions and looked at him with his dead mother's eyes. Suddenly, this enchanting landscape vanished in a blank. Something struck him hard upon the face and breast. He had fallen to the floor. The blood ran from his broken nose and his bruised lips, and for a moment he was dazed and stunned, and lay with his closed eyes, his face against the door. In a few moments, he had recovered, and then realized that his fall, by withdrawing his eyes, had broken the spell which held him. He felt that now, by keeping his gaze averted, he would be able to retreat. But the thought of that serpent within a few feet of his head, yet unseen, perhaps in the very act of springing upon him and throwing its coils about his throat, was too horrible. He lifted his head and stared again into those baleful eyes and was again in bondage. Now ensued a fearful scene. The man prone upon the floor within a yard of his enemy raised the upper part of his body upon his elbows, his head thrown back, his legs extended to their full length. His face was white between its gouts of blood. His eyes were strained open to their uttermost expansion. There was froth upon his lips. It dropped off in flakes. Strong convulsions ran through his body, making almost serpentine undulations. He bent himself at the waist, shifting his legs from side to side, and every movement left him a little nearer to the snake. He thrust his hands forward to brace himself back, and yet constantly advanced upon his elbows. Dr. Druring and his wife were at this moment in the library. Their conversation was interrupted by a mighty cry which rang through the silent house like the voice of a demon shouting in a tomb. Again and yet again it sounded, with terrible distinctness. They rang to their feet, the man confused, the lady pale and speechless with fright. Almost before the echoes of the last cry had died away, the doctor was out of the room, springing up the staircase two steps at a time. In the corridor, in front of Brayton's chamber, he met some servants who had come down from the upper floor. Together, they rushed at the door without knocking. It was unfastened and gave way. Brayton lay upon his stomach on the floor, dead. His head and arms were partly concealed under the footrail of the bed. They pulled the body away, turning it upon the bed. The face was daubed with blood and froth. The eyes were wide open, staring. A dreadful sight. Yes, he died in a fit, said the scientist, bending his knee and placing his hand upon the heart. And while in that position, he happened to glance under the bed. Good Lord, how did this thing get in here? He reached under the bed, pulled out the snake and flung it, still coiled, to the center of the room, whence with a harsh shuffling sound, it slid across the polished floor until stopped by the wall where it lay without motion. It was a stuffed snake. Its eyes were two shoe buttons.
This has been another review of a great short story of world literature. And now, here is Nelson Almstead with some closing comments.
Ladies and gentlemen, our story tonight, The Man and the Snake, was written by that very vivid American journalist and author, Ambrose Bierce, and is my idea of a very clever psychological study, brilliantly written. Bierce delighted in propounding the psychological and philosophical in his many short stories, some of the best of which are An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, The Man with Two Lives, Horseman in the Sky, and The Man and the Snake. In this narrative review tonight, Bierce points to the psychology of suggestion on the human mind. Harker Brayton scoffed as he read the ancient theory of the hypnotic power of the snake. And yet, when he faced what he imagined was a live and deadly snake, this suggestion he had just read amplified itself in his mind to such an extent that he literally frightened himself to death. One thing is certain. The most vacillating and undeterminable factor of humanity is the human mind, which is why the subject is so often the basis of better stories of world literature. Ambrose Bierce was born in 1839. He served as an officer in the Civil War. In 1914, he joined Pancho Villa in Mexico and has never been heard from since. Just how or when he died, no one knows. It has been only recently that readers have discovered his masterful writing, so to speak. There's been a very slow but definite Bierce revival among all who admire highly finished fictional studies. Tomorrow night, the story up for review is Rappaccini's Daughter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. This is an unusual narrative about a beautiful young lady who was nurtured from birth and poisoned so that her very breath was deadly. Until tomorrow night, good night and good reading.
NBC presents Nelson Almstead and his world's greatest short stories three nights each week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, at the same time over most of these same stations. Rappaccini's Daughter by Nathaniel Hawthorne is scheduled for tomorrow night, and we hope you'll be with us.
That's our strange tale for this week. I'll be back next Sunday with a story from the Weird Circle. In between now and then, there's a lot more old-time radio at relicradio.com. You'll find past episodes from this show, all the others, and our Shoutcast stream. If you'd like to help support this and all of the shows, you can do so from the website as well. Give that donate button a click. Find some downloadable collections for certain donation amounts if you're interested in those. So any amount is always appreciated. My thanks to those who have helped out, and thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again next Sunday with another episode of Relic Radio's Strange Tales.